jail where Ray is located, you're cleared through a general control center downstairs, and the visitors communicate by microphone with deputies to the control center room. This nerve center of the protective system is equipped with 3 red and 3 green lights, and those on the door tell you at what point the door can be unlocked. The red alert means don't open the door. And once through the control center, the family or the lawyer passes through a door in a small anteroom where a sign reads, no guns allowed, and there you're searched by deputies. And from there, you're taken to an elevator to the cell area, into a brightly lighted area. And outside the cell, 5 feet from the entrance of the cell, are 2 unarmed guards stationed behind a desk. And at one end of the desk is a TV that's provided for Ray and the people visiting him for his entertainment. The other end of the desk is a monitor on Ray's image in constant view. A second monitor of Ray is kept on the second floor of the jail, and a third monitor is in a wooden cabinet on the desk of Sheriff Morris. And when the cell door opens to Ray, the red light goes on the sheriff's desk downstairs. Ray's food is placed in a steel lockbox, and the key to the box is kept in a bulletproof control center. And the guard on duty carries the food box to Ray's cell, and another guard is fetched for the cell key from the control center. And the guards are required to have security clearances, and special tokens are given to the guards, and they're exchanged with each shift to pass the token to another guard. And without the tokens, the guards cannot leave or enter a room. One guard has to give it to another guard. And his food is in this locked box, and it's passed to another bulletproof control room and handed to him through a process of 4 different people. Now, this is the way James Ray is handled. If he doesn't have cancer, goodness knows what he's getting, maybe out of that steel box, some radiation, goodness knows what. But that's the way you handle the political prisoners like Sirhan and James Ray and Charles Manson. Once they're captured, no one can speak to them. A man, William Bradford Ewing, wanted to write a book about James Ray. He never could see him. Everything Ray wrote had to go through the guards, through the controls, was documented, passed to Huey back and forth. And when he passed one note saying that there was a conspiracy, that was the end of Bradford Huey's writing about conspiracy. Then the next issue, he said it was a lone assassin, and the whole story was changed. The whole intent of his book was changed.
I've always wondered about that. He was going to make several disclosures. I was reading the condensed form of that publications that were putting excerpts out for the promoting the book, and that's where it stopped off. You know, it would seem as though the authorities in Ray's case have been watching avidly the Mission Impossible show from the steps they've taken, and I don't see any way anybody could get in there, even using the IM forces tactics.
Oh, no way. No way.
I would think the only way that, from what you've described, if they ever have a power failure and a fire at the same time, Ray will probably die, because it seems virtually impossible if an emergent type of situation such as an earthquake or natural disaster would strike, they could ever get Ray out in time.
Never.
Or the guards that are guarding him. You know, I want to describe, if I could, to your listeners, paranoia is something that we hear a lot about, but it's something we have a lot of true, Gloria, but it's something that people, take with a grain of salt. If you've been a member, if you've been fortunate enough, that's probably that's the correct way of saying it, if you've been fortunate enough to be a member of a police agency and then are on the outside looking in, you can feel extreme paranoia and know that it's real. When I went down to testify at Manson's trial last week, when I was in court, I experienced some very strange feelings. I was noticing, first of all, there were only 2 deputies, bailiffs, in the court after I was searched outside prior to coming in. I was a surprise witness. No one knew who I was. But as soon as the deputies found out I was a former member of their own department, the phones were all lit in the courtroom. Every deputy, they could get his hands on a phone. They were calling intelligence. They were calling records. They were digging my CUME file out, everything they could possibly do. And within the space of 5 minutes, this courtroom, which only had 2 bailiffs, unarmed, was suddenly filled with an excess of 8 to 10 officers, all of the TAC squad, SEB, all armed, all with mace, all with their batons. And they sat there, made a game out of, while I was testifying, sitting there, fingering their mace, their guns, and their batons while looking at me. And the entire back row of the courtroom now contained law enforcement officers, either plainclothes intelligence people or members of the tactical unit who sat there listening to my testimony. I feel at the time they were trying to find someone who knew me personally, who could come in and identify me as being a former member of the department and perhaps add something to the prosecution's case. But it was a very interesting feeling.
How would they do, break you down by...
They might have. They might have indicated
your credibility or something?
My credibility, yes.
Yeah.
I might point out, those of your listeners who follow the case of Michael Hannon, who was a former L.A. police officer who is now an ACLU attorney in Los Angeles, will find that most police departments, when an officer leaves and he becomes a rogue ex-cop, they do their best to discredit him wherever possible, and they made him out to be everything but a communist. When I left my own department, they circulated memos to the station, first of all, to Malibu and East Los Angeles, where I'd worked, that no one was to discuss my having been there, and furthermore, intimated that I must have been on heavy drugs, because there's no other way they could account for my suddenly winding up on the left side of the spectrum and having all these revelations about police work and suppression and repression in the United States and in law enforcement, because they felt that when I came on, their screening process was so great that they would have weeded me out had I been of that political persuasion.
Why did you leave the sheriff's department? What was the thing that made you leave?
I left because I contacted a radio station in Los Angeles, KLAC, which at the time was a news station, and I told them about the cover-up of the Spahn Ranch raid. And
what bothered you about it?
Well, the fact that I noticed too much information being suppressed for political gain and for prestige.
Uh-huh. And you didn't even know they were involved with the Sharon Tate thing at the time?
I knew this. I made this disclosure the day that the Sharon Tate, the Manson arrest was announced by the L.A. Police Department in Inyo County.
But you felt that the whole law enforcement group was putting something down on the actual murders of the people involved?
Yes, I had a feeling that the whole thing was being used politically by the sheriff and by the district attorney.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of interplay between the sheriff's department and the L.A. City Police, because they're both large agencies in Los Angeles, and they're always jockeying for political advantage in the county.
Yeah.
But I just came to a point where I saw too much going down, and Manson was the Manson case was just something which was too great to go unheralded to the public. I just felt that people had to be made aware, if possible.
So
I was very naive when I contacted the press, and I felt that, wow, they'd really jump on this, and they'd light up torches, and we would stop cursing the darkness and light a match.
Well, this is what I thought with my
research.
Somebody
stuffed out the match.
Someone stuffed out the match. When I found out really what happened in the John Kennedy thing, I thought, well, you know, now people really, now that they see this, here's this document, here's this evidence, here's what they said, and it doesn't match the evidence, and look, our government was overthrown, and people would say, oh, I don't like Vietnam, I don't like Lyndon Johnson, I don't like the violence coming down, we'll follow you, and right on. No, they came to me like, what's your real motive? What are you doing this for? Tell us the truth. You know, you can't be altruistic. What's your motive? And I said, no, if this is true and if the murders are out on the streets, then we'll have other murders, you know, and deaths. And then Martin Luther King was killed, and Malcolm X, and they said, well, you know, if a guy's going to be political and stick his neck out, he's going to get killed, you know, and there's no link. And then when Robert Kennedy was killed, I thought, surely people would come to me then and say, oh, now it's time for you to tell us what you knew about the murder of John Kennedy, because the Robert Kennedy thing is so wide open, you know, and so easy to see the eve of the primary, when he's about to grasp the chance of being a president and so forth. But the reaction was different. People turned away, use the expression instant turnoff. People who were angry at my suggesting a conspiracy in the John Kennedy were simply adamant, and don't tell me a thing about Bobby. They were worse. There's not even a book written, except the two written by people involved in covering up the murder. Nobody even had an investigation that was public or cared on who was in the ambassador, who was seeing him, or who the security guards were. They said, don't tell us anymore. I don't want to know. That's over. And he was buried.
Well, May, the attitude is like when Nader came forward and said that the General Motors Chevrolets were defective in the motor mounts and so on. The attitude of the public at that point was, well, simply, well, I don't own a Chevrolet, so I'm not going to get excited about it. Mm-hmm. The whole idea is that people are, there are three main groups of thought in this area about getting involved. There's the group, a very small minority, who knows what's going on, who's got it together, and who, in some cases, have gone underground preparing for what is going to go down. There's another group which says, wow, I understand the whole thing, but it's too damn big for me to do anything about, so I'm going to sit here and I'm going to really mess my mind up. I'm going to smoke, and I'm going to drop it. I'm going to get a heavy music scene and, you know, drop out. And there's a third group which is unaware of what's going on. The vast, uninformed,
Well, they're saying don't show it to
majority.
Me. Yeah, their eyes won't fall on those things. You know, there was somebody in my home last week who is prominent in the San Francisco area who writes articles that influences the minds of young people, and I won't mention his name, but if I did, you'd all know who he is, and he's very prominent in the northern area and into the young people, and writes articles for the Chronicle all the time on political things in the United States that affect youth, and sat in my living room, was very resistant to meet me, and a mutual friend said, I want you to meet her because maybe it would help you with the political things you're writing. You're just at the brink of the water, but you won't get in, you know, you won't dip. And there was such resistance to meeting me that he wanted to show that he really could handle everything, I guess, so he finally came up. And we sat in the living room, and the resistance was so great, and I began to just breathe a little bit about how conspiracies affect what he's doing. And he said, I don't believe a word of what you're saying, you know. And here I've done, you know, almost 8 years research, fully documented. And we didn't even go in an area that I call the archives where my work is because it would be offensive to him. It would be taking somebody who has a real hang-up about body and sex, who's been repressed all their life, and bringing a bunch of nude people for dinner and saying, you know, let's have dinner. He would have been so offended by the raw skin of the research. You know, the thing would just blow his mind. And as long as he can talk in generalities, which is what all the men like Jack Anderson or Walter Reston or Max Lerner, Harrison Salisbury, Tom Wicker, the intellectual elite, if you don't show them the body, they'll write about love and sex or government. You know, don't show me that nude thing. You know, I may just see what it is. I may even believe it or go for it. You know, as long as I don't see it and it's covered up, I'm safe. See?
Unfortunately, what has happened in the United States is the large media reporters, your
terrible
well-known reporters, they go into a story too often with their eyes closed. They know what the story's about. They know what they want to hear. They want to hear sensational things. And if you tell them straight from the shoulder and it's the truth and it's not according to what, you know, what they've been led to believe they want to hear, what they think their readers want to hear is, you know, like they want to do a sensational story, we'll say, on group marriages or group sex or sexual promiscuity in, we'll say, Sweden. And if they go to a researcher who tells them there is no greater amount of sexual, there's no greater amount of sexual promiscuity in Sweden than there is in the United States, they're going to go to another researcher before they do their story.
They stay at this very safe level, and they say, don't put it in front of my eyes. Mm-hmm. And they make money off the system. They're the system's liberals. They're really the eunuchs walking around. They're the whole system's liberal. They make their check every month, every day, writing their columns, and teasing you, like the fact that Richard Nixon had a Nazi worshiping in the White House. Maybe Jack Anderson got $500 to tell you that. But if you say, do you want to know what other Nazis he was with who were also in Dallas, he doesn't answer your letter. He'll only tell you about a Nazi. That's safe. Don't link it to the other ones, you know. I don't want to know it.
If I can paraphrase Mark Twain, Mark Twain was noted for saying that there's a lot more truth in the world than there'll, be, you know, than there'll ever be a demand for. People don't want the truth. What they want is things which make them feel warm and toasty inside and make them feel secure. Now, we get into the security thing. Let's ask ourselves. I've got some notes here. I was thinking about the Tate killings. We'll suppose for one moment now that we had a group having a party and they were wearing, you know, straight clothes.
Maybe
a Brooks Pursuit, an evening gown, and they're having daiquiris, and they're all married to somebody in the room, and they're not trying to, you know, put the make on somebody else's wife. They're all doing the straight middle America scene. They're having a nice cocktail party, and Manson and his group, okay, would burst in and then wipe all these people out. Sure, it would be in the press, but it wouldn't be in the press quite as much as an incident that we do have here, a real-life incident where one non-group was attacked by another non-group. Non-group meaning that they were not... They're recognized by societies having no redeeming social value, so as such, I call them non-groups from the society point of view. Now, if that had happened, the thing would have died out very rapidly. The case would have been, you know, fine, gone to court, trial, everything. But the fact that here were these people leading a hedonistic lifestyle, there was promiscuous sex amongst people who weren't married to one another. There were males and females
right,
in the same room that weren't fully clothed.
Yeah.
Female parts of the anatomy exposed. And there was narcotics there, and it was just terrible. Also, there was a lot of money, and the fact that most of the people involved in they were in the Tate home were, you know, they were pseudo-intellectuals. They thought they were in the left movement.
They were into political things.
They
were with Robert Kennedy the night he was killed. They had dinner with him the night he went to the ambassador.
Very political.
And the Folger girl worked at Watts. She worked against Yorty's campaign for a black Bradley. Mm-hmm. You know, they were into the black thing, the underdog scene, working in that, and maybe trafficking drugs, and they didn't have any clothes on.
Mm-hmm.
And it really made a exciting story, you know?
Let's also get into the homosexual scene we were discussing earlier. In every major political assassination in the United States, May and I were discussing the fact that a homosexual has been present.
Wait, we'll get people putting this down.
Well,
we're not anti-homosexual.
No, I'm not trying to discredit homosexuals. What I'm trying to point out is that homosexuals, by nature of the fact that they must lead a clandestine life, existence, are subjects, have been used, and are still being used for political gain.
Remember, Gloria, we talked about I was going to do a show on sex life and political assassinations, on the use of about 30 or 40 single men. Well, this is why Preston came up with men, single men involved in that massacre, similar to the other ones.
Right. Here's some facts about the Manson case that many people didn't. You have to read between the lines of the press reports. First of all, Steve Parent, the young man who was visiting the caretaker at the Tate residence, was a junior grade burglar and a narcotics dealer. Now, we don't want to get into the libelous area. I hope I'm not getting into the libelous area. The fact is quite plain that the young man was homosexual, for all intents and purposes, and he and Steve Parent were conducting a liaison. And,
of course, this fellow, the caretaker, was brought in for 3 days and was released, and the circumstances of how he didn't hear any sounds and what he was doing on the ground and the Weimaraner dogs and all that has never really been investigated. They just hushed that whole thing up. I don't even think he came into the trial thing at all. It was just set that Manson did it.
Last I heard, he had a suit against the city for a false arrest, and he's living with his parents back east someplace. He immediately left the area.
Yeah.
But it would appear as though we get into a very sensitive area when we start talking about the caretaker's involvement, I can't even recall his name, his involvement plus his relationship or alleged relationship
with
Steve Parent. Now, I'm not going to come forward and say that I have facts that Steve Parent was a homosexual and he was a burglar and he dealt in narcotics. There are certain conclusions we can draw from the information available to us.
But coming down on this group was the way that they could control the minds of the people and really get them scared, like, look what's happening, that these people are doing these things. And nobody really cared about the victims, but it made good copy to read about it.
Right.
In fact, I think everybody should buy the Playboy, December Playboy of this month, the interview of Polanski, Sharon Tate's husband. It's the first interview that he's had in 2 years, and I might read just the way it starts off. Playboy said to him, "For the past 2 years, you've remained silent about the murder and your wife and friends, despite the enormous and lurid exposure. Are you willing to tell your side of it now?" And Polanski said, "It's not something I talk about with friends, but I want to go through it once from the beginning to the end, and I have trouble, difficulty in reconstructing that period." He said the way the news media came down on him, it was unbelievable. He said Time magazine, referred to the way he lived, and they referred to the films he made. And he said, in quotes from Time, it was a scene as grisly as anything in Polanski's films, exploration of dark and melancholy side of the human character, end quote. And Polanski said, "I was baffled at the cheapness, the platitude of writing, the sensationalism, and none of the truth." He said that they used his movies as an example of what happens to people and tried to make the victims guilty of their own murder. The reporting, he said, about Sharon and the murders was virtually criminal. Reading the papers, I could not believe my eyes. They blamed the victims for their own murders. I really despise the press. I didn't always. And then he goes on to the thing about the orgies and sex and sadism and celebrities and masochism and suicide and witchcraft and rituals. And the truth will come out, I feel, someday, very shortly, or I hope it will in our lifetime, President and Gloria, that the truth is going to come out that these people were selected by a certain group that engineered this particular massacre. And the banking, where the money came from in Texas, the credit cards in Texas, they're investigating in Kansas City. There were rumors of the banking and so forth coming from Kansas City.
Preston was making a point.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
What point? I lost my train.
You had brought up the homosexual involvement in the...
Well, I wish this, that they wanted to come down on this whole group that was doing their own individual thing, that homosexuality is not a thing that should be looked down upon, but people's minds are so twisted that to make it look like a really gory scene, they could come down on all these people. They knew their individual habits.
And then the LaBianca killings were simply a matter of Mr. and Mrs. Middle America, Mr. and Mrs. Nice were attacked. Also to point out that not only will this degenerate segment of society attack people who are almost in their own group. You see, you can't say the Tates were in the same group as Manson because Manson and the Klan and the family, because the Tates were, you know, they were pseudo everything. The whole group there, they all had access to tremendous amounts of money, and they all made token efforts to become liberals to salve their own conscience. Whereas the LaBiancas were, you know, solid American type people. They were in business. They had money. They, you know, would never, I'm sure, got involved in anything like what the people at the Tate House were involved in.
Yeah, well, the individual habits of these people were used to hide the motives of the murder.
Exactly.
You know, we were reading the article yesterday of a man in the State Department who got a security clearance because he's homosexual, and they said the time of blackmailing people, putting fears because of their individual sexual habits should be over, you know, and they should accept them as individuals. But coming down on this particular house with the drugs and the sex and the nudity and everything, it made a shocking story, and it called attention to a man named Manson, who was a creation of the news media. Now, in the Playboy article, Polanski knows full well that Manson was not a hippie. And this is an interesting thing. He refers to Manson as being just nothing but an ex-convict and getting out of the jail. And this is what he said. One of the things he said is people have to dismiss the fact that Manson had a criminal track record. They don't want to think of that he spent a great deal of time in prison. He had a long record before he tried to be a hippie. And his philosophy was basically criminal, and no one mistook him for Jesus. Then Polanski went on to say, hippies don't exist anymore, and the hippie movement has degenerated. But the degeneration came from the top, not the bottom. When the kids began preaching new values, the government tried to beat their ideas out of them. Now, Polanski is saying that the government is trying to change our value system. And I think if we work long and hard enough on who Tex Watson was, who trained these people with military ambushes, who that ex-Marine was who's mentioned in Ed Sanders' book, who helped Manson, you know, with his Vietnam experience, helped him back at the Spahn Ranch. What kind of help was that? Our ex-Marines coming home and training Manson. You see, he was groomed with a hippie jargon, but that wasn't the real Charlie Manson. And that kind of mind control of the young people is, and the parents, all the parents of the people going around today, come down on their children, and if the kids get stabbed or thrown out of a car, they say, huh, that's what you deserved. You were hitchhiking.
May, it appears as though what the government is trying to do is to convince people the value system, what they're trying to set up the value system is that they want to convince people that nirvana is people living in the suburbs in a split level with a lot of electric appliances, with plastic cases which are warm to touch, and a two cherub-faced kids and a pretty wife and a large dog that, you know,
yeah,
barks when you come home. This is the myth, and this whole myth means you go out and you buy this house, you buy the products that go inside to make this house work. You buy, you consume. You must consume products.
And if you don't consume, then Rand does a study about how to take care of you.
Right. They'll decide how you're going to consume.
Yeah.
You must consume to keep this glorious society of ours going. You know, if you don't buy a new toaster every 3 years and a new car every 3.5, society as we know it will come to a standstill. You go to France, you go anywhere in Europe, you see the average car is 10 to 15 years old, is my experience when I was in France. And people there, they make use of things they buy. They don't buy things to consume them. We buy things here. Everything is a consumable. We must consume everything we use, and that includes people.
Yeah.
We are very busy consuming people that help make our society go. That is, for instance, if you were to eliminate poverty and illiteracy in the United States, you just knocked two very important political issues right in the, you know, in a cocked hat. You can't eliminate things in the United States that politicians need to get elected on. What would man use for his platform if there was no poverty, if there was no racism, if there was no materialism, if there was no war? All of these things help get people reelected each year.
And what will Evel Younger and Mitchell and Agnew do if there are no youth to come down either? Yeah, or Reagan. Read the speeches. If the prisons are bad and the prisoners object, they say the radicals did it. What would they do without this new class of hippie to come down on? And you'll see more of it in the news media. They need poverty. They need this young group. They need the drug thing to arrest them. If they become too aware now of the kind of things we're talking about, they'll come in and bust them, you know, and ruin their lives, you know, and get their jobs fired and everything. They needed this group of young people to come down on as they became more intelligent and aware. And they did it through the creation of Charlie Manson, and it was highly financed and very carefully skilled and programmed and costumed.
It's the only way the Youngers and the Mitchells in the United States can justify their existence. First, if you don't have any poverty, you will have a minimal amount of crime. And with a minimal amount of crime, people such as Younger can't justify their existence. Police departments will not be able to justify large expenditures for electronic surveillance gear. And the big thing right now is every police department wants its own computer.
Yeah. So
Berkeley just got theirs over the objections, I think, of the city council. My friends, they're putting a lot more into these computers than just information on who's wanted for traffic warrants.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think we're going to wind this up, Gloria. Huh?
Yeah, in about a minute.
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the things you have to think about is the fact, again, that Polanski says that Manson is more like the story of In Cold Blood or Hitler's Army, that the books coming out that try to tell you that young minds were molded by Manson are not true. The murders that were done were identical to the Charles Whitman or Richard Speck or Lieutenant Calley. They're done by straight people, not people with grass, not people with LSD. They're done by straight people, criminal acts. And then they put the guitar in their hand or a fringe coat to tell you that marijuana and LSD were responsible for these murders. There isn't a bit of evidence to document this. And I think that we should very shortly get more truth out on this subject.
Right. But do you have any hope? Like you say, they want something nice and warm to hang on to comfort them. Do you think the bomb will go off at the convention? Do you think there's any way that it can be prevented?
It's a hypothetical situation, but I think that if a bomb doesn't go off there, something else will take place. And my big question for the people and your listening audience is, if this thing does go down and there is a national, state of a national emergency declared and the guard scoops up all the left-wing people, will the people who are not yet radicalized, who remain, will they, in essence, immediately go underground and twice the numbers of the people arrested and carry on the work of the people who were arrested?
I don't think they will. In Greece, a general apathy
took
over.
I hope they do.
I don't know.
Well, that is a hope.
That's he's hopeful.
The only
I'm not.
Hope we have.
Yeah, I'm hopeful.
You might also ask people that, you know, when you go through school, I remember every morning the first thing we did the Pledge of Allegiance bit, and the last line of the Pledge of Allegiance, and liberty and justice for all. Mm-hmm. Let that ring in your ears, and then pick up your morning newspaper and read it, and find out what a farce that last line is.
Yeah.
Thank you, Preston Guillory. Thank you, May.
Been listening to Dialogue. Dialogue is a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.